It's the most wonderful time of the year. By which I mean...
It's after Halloween.
Yeah, daylight savings. It's getting...
No, daylight savings is not happening. No.
Sorry, standard time.
Thank
standard
you.
Time.
Thank
sorry.
You.
Daylight
Get
savings is over.
Right.
The end of daylight savings. Yeah, so it's a little chillier. It's getting dark earlier. And I've started playing Christmas music in the car.
Okay, first of all, two things.
Yeah.
We've only been doing LKTV 2 weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
And I already cannot listen to our theme song without hearing you in my head interjecting the words TV into
the
song.
You know what? It's funny you should mention that because, I started listening to my Christmas music this week, and whenever I hear Andy Williams sing Sweet Little Jesus Boy, I can't hear it without thinking of you chiming in, he shot Liberty Valance. So, we're even on that front. I can't. That song now is branded.
I forgot I did that.
That song is branded to me forever. This is a podcast of the cinema.
I totally forgot that I did that.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor for The Wrap.
I'm so great.
And a film critic for What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube. And you are Dave White, film critic for linoleum-knife.com.
And I also shot Liberty Valance.
Yes, and ruiner of Christmas songs.
You didn't begin listening to Christmas songs on November 1st, like you are contractually obligated to do.
The only reason that I didn't was because I was listening to a lot of podcasts that day.
No, I know.
I didn't listen to any actual music.
But... It made me...
But I had loaded up my iPhone.
And it made me think about all my good advice for you about how you should listen to the Christmas music that your iTunes has not yet played. Because even though you have this idealized version of iTunes in your head that will ultimately give you everything through shuffle, the cold fact of life is that it will not.
Well, so far, my shuffle has been taking me to a lot of different and unusual places.
Anyway.
If it turns out that it's not doing that, then yes, I'll make a special separate playlist of songs that it hasn't played.
Then I
before.
Began thinking about myself.
That doesn't take long for you.
And I had to wonder.
I had to ask myself.
Do I have a lot of Christmas music in my iTunes? Because, you know, I'm sort of less interested in Christmas music than you are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not less interested
Most people are.
I'm not less interested in Christmas.
Sure, no.
I'm less interested in hearing the Christmas music all the time.
Right.
From November 1st to December 25th.
Right.
Even though...
Oh, not December 25th.
Disagreeing with the people... Who say that it doesn't, that you're not allowed to do anything until after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That is not how this house works.
No.
In this house, November 1st to December 25th, that's Christmas. There's a little pit stop in the middle of it all for Thanksgiving,
right.
But it's Christmas.
And really, we don't even stop at the 25th in terms of, like, the tree stays up, and I listen to Christmas music until Epiphany on January 6th.
That is weird. Like, I'm
6th.
You got me to the point where I will not take down the tree until Epiphany, just as per your request.
Right.
But December 26th, those Christmas songs are over. That's done. Like, you go back to headphones.
Fine.
If you're going to keep doing it until January 6th,
yes.
Headphones.
All right.
Anyway,
I'm all about 12th Night.
I began thinking of myself and my own iTunes with my own Christmas music in it, and I thought, how much do I actually have? Like, I didn't really know how much I had.
Well, let's see. I know you have Low, and I know you have Saint Etienne, and I know you have, what's her face who sings Joy?
Tracy Thorne. Yeah.
I don't know what else you've got. Maybe some Rosemary Clooney.
I got Rosemary Clooney. I got Mary Margaret O'Hara, if anybody knows who
right.
that is.
Oh, right. Yes. You've got the Kylie EP, but soon you'll have the full-length Kylie album.
That's right, I will. No, you're going to be surprised. I went to my iTunes to look at how much. I have almost 9 hours of Christmas music.
Wow.
In there.
Would not have seen that coming.
I, you know what? I think it had to do with maybe you putting it in somehow.
I don't think
over the years or whatever. You tossing me a disc and saying, oh, here's some old-timey stuff that you
might
like.
Well, maybe, yeah.
You know, that's primarily what it is.
And we used to get those great annual Amoeba compilations.
Right.
That the employees got.
Right. We don't get those anymore.
No, we don't.
Because...
we're out of the loop.
Aaron. Damn it. What else was I going to tell you? Oh, no, just those two things. Mm-hmm. Who is the sponsor? Who's our sponsor?
Linoleum Knife Podcast.
Is brought to you by...
Reed Martin's independent film guide, The Real Truth, available on Amazon.com as a paperback or as an ebook from iTunes.
Is that the entire sentence?
That's it.
Okay, good. Did you tell him that we were sorry for forgetting last week during our fifth anniversary show?
Yes, he was very understanding.
Okay.
It was a crazy show last week. There was a lot of moving parts. I had to open a bottle of champagne on cue.
True. You did that, though. You did it really nicely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You kept thinking I was going to put an eye out. I'm like, dude.
No, what I kept thinking was that you're going to spill champagne on this equipment.
No.
That
it wasn't like happen. We were in. It wasn't a locker room after the Super Bowl and somebody had shaken it up. It was fine.
You know, champagne can do all kinds of crazy things. You don't know.
It was fine.
Here's the thing I learned this week.
Mm-hmm.
When you have diarrhea.
God. Yes.
And someone asks you, hey, how's it going? The best answer in the world is, I have diarrhea. Because it makes them laugh.
Or regret having asked you.
I used it on 3 different friends this week, and all of them thought it was hilarious.
No, I'm glad that worked out for you.
It was such a good day of making my friends happy with my misfortune that I jotted it down. This is like, I have to remember this.
Tips for future.
I may use it in the future when I don't even have that.
just to brighten someone's day.
Just to make somebody smile. Yeah. Try it with your friends.
Well, I did my best to make you feel better yesterday by sitting you down on the sofa to watch the new Blu-ray from Henstooth video of Pippi Longstocking.
Freckles on her nose, diddle diddle dee, a girl came riding into town one day, diddle diddle, she was quite a sight. It's Pippi Longstocking, hey ho ho, why hee ha ha, it's Pippi Longstocking, there's no one like her. Happy as can be, diddle diddle Pippi tells you stories. You just wait and see. Cha la 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 la, she's quite a girl.
I'm not even gonna try this one.
Pippi's world is fun. Diddle diddle dee, she makes kids happy. Her make believe may stun. Diddle diddle the grown ups here in town. Pippi's quite unique. Diddle diddle with her smile disarming. She is such an imp. Tra la 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 la. You'll love her too.
You will. It is the law. We have to explain Pippi Longstocking to our younger listeners, I think.
It made me happy. It didn't make my stomach better.
Oh, well.
I had a bad stomach.
Sorry. Yeah. I tried. as a child, I remember going to the movies. You know, we've talked about the whole kiddie matinee thing, and I did not have nearly as much exposure to you to it as you did.
Yeah.
But I do remember there being kiddie matinees of Pippi Longstocking.
Yes.
And my mother forcing my poor brother and sister to take me because they were slightly older. And they resented that for years.
They should.
Because those movies are pretty terrible.
Uniquely bad.
Yeah.
Each one awfuler than the last.
Already sort of bizarre and weird, and then on top of it, dubbed into English with so little grace.
A Swedish television show.
Yeah, based on the popular novels.
Swedish television show, chopped up and given a little transitional materials and an ending, and then released into theaters as two feature films.
Right.
Pippi Longstocking, and then Pippi Goes on Board. Then two more films made as theatrical releases, not as television shorts.
Pippi in the South Seas.
Made the next year. Four films in 2 years, 1969 and 1970, starring three children, the girl who plays Pippi, Inger Nilsson. And two other kids who play the kids,
Tommy and Annika.
Yeah, whatever. None of whom ever acted again for the rest of their lives, with good reason. Whatever you think a child actor is capable of doing, think of the opposite. And that's these three kids. Furthermore, some of the most, grubby production design that has ever visited a children's film. In the same league, although not as revolting, as Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny.
Oof, yeah. That's, yeah.
Or The Christmas That Almost Wasn't, which is also a grimy little movie.
Yeah, another weird little Euro bauble from that era.
And I think, I don't think this is even going out on a limb. The worst English language dubbing that I have ever seen. Now, I have seen all the Godzilla movies. They're charming. Their English dubbing is charming. This English dubbing is so weird that when I saw these films as a child, the first time I ever saw...
You knew something was off.
I remember sitting in the theater at the kiddie matinee thinking, there's something wrong with this movie. And I couldn't even put my finger on what it was. I didn't have the vocabulary or the understanding to know what the problem was. They're three children voiced by adults.
Yeah.
Doing child voices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the amount of screeching in these films is staggering. Why then have I seen the first one, Pippi Longstocking, at least five times in my life? Why? Why has this happened?
It's the kind of car accident that you keep coming back to and thinking, who thought this was a good idea? And who thought it was a good idea for children? I mean, because most children...
The four children element is actually my favorite part of it.
Because you look at most children's films and there's something resembling a message. I made the joke in my DVD Obscura column at movies.com that some people say the Ramones invented punk rock.
That is not true.
It was Pippi Longstocking.
It wasn't even Iggy Pop. It was Pippi Longstocking.
She is an anarchist.
Yeah.
The whole message of these movies is eat all the candy and adults are stupid. I mean, basically.
and to borrow from a Sex Pistols lyric, get pissed, destroy. that's what she does. She runs amok and destroys things, knocks other human beings down to the ground, pulls rugs out from under adults, crashes things on their heads.
Takes all the food at the party and then picks her nose.
She's
an imp. Tra-la-la-la-la. You'll love her too.
You'll love her too. If you don't love her too, she will drop a horse on you. She will pick up the horse because she is the strongest girl in the world.
Yes.
And then she'll flatten you under it.
Oh, man.
And then run off and be like, haha, I don't care. Like,
you have to see these movies just to believe they exist.
Someone knocks on her door at Villa Coola and she's like, come in or don't come in, leave, I don't care, it makes no difference to me. Like, she says this.
She's punk rock.
So she's punk rock, and I guess that's why I love her. Tra la 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 la. I love her too. She is such an imp. This disgusting garbage child. My hero.
Anyway, now they're on Blu-ray. So they look better than ever.
My favorite part of the story is how you specifically asked the distributor for this Blu-ray set.
Oh, yeah. As soon as I heard it, I was like, I got to see these again.
They sent you the email and said, we have them.
No. I saw it on Amazon.
And you found you hunted them down and you're like, I want this.
Yeah, and I'd already been in touch with them about something else that's coming out. And I was like, oh, please, please send me these. And they did, and we watched them.
If you've never seen either any of these films before and you want that sort of experience.
If you want to put something on at a party that's not going to offend anyone, you know, because there's no nudity or violence.
But we'll always
But you want people to just kind of stop and go, what
is this?
Is this?
Yes.
Pippi Longstocking. I'm telling you. The only other movie that I remember seeing as a kid where the dubbing threw me off.
Yeah.
Was Super Bug Super Agent.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think we've talked about on the show before.
German.
Like the German Love Bug ripoff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oof. So the Peanuts movie.
Yes.
Speaking of children.
After years of waiting.
Speaking of imps. I watched your What the Flick showdown with Christy Lemire.
Oh, I love her.
And both of you are right.
Mm, yeah, no, I'd say fair enough. Yeah.
But first, let's talk about the screening itself. So it was the screening itself was 20 minutes late.
Yes.
Starting.
Not the premiere. Those are never on time. This was the press screening they had 2 days before the premiere.
Yeah. So the screening's 20 minutes late. Now, normally a screening starts 10 minutes after the time it's supposed to start.
Right.
That's just the way it works.
Yeah.
If they say it's at 7, it's at 7:10. That's to give people a reasonable amount of time to be a little bit late in case something crazy happened.
Sure.
But this is Los Angeles. And
there was traffic does not count as an
excuse. That's not an excuse. ever. If you live in Los Angeles and you're late for anything and you say, traffic, you're a horrible person.
Because guess what?
You live here like everybody else.
And there's always traffic.
In the words of our friend James Rocky, you didn't have to dig a tunnel to get here. You knew the risks involved in getting in your car. So this one's 20 minutes late. 15 is really pushing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 20 is unacceptable.
By 20, you know that they're holding it for one person, and the message being the one person who isn't here is far more important than the 15 or 20 or 50 or however many of you that are here.
And then when this person walked in, no one recognized this person.
I don't even think this person was a critic. I don't know who this person was.
Anyway. So at the 20-minute mark, I went out and I'm going to ask questions. I need to know.
As you do.
Some information. I said to the publicist, so what's going on? The publicist said, there's someone stuck at the gate. We're holding the screening for them. Can I help you with something? So this publicist was not having my attitude at all.
Right.
And was giving as good as I was giving.
Mm.
And giving back as good as I was giving.
Your nemesis.
Honestly, I got to give this person some respect.
Mm.
Because you're always telling me you know, no more going to the Apple Genius Bar for you, Dave White, because you terrify people. It's true. Well, this publicist was not terrified of me. It's true.
Did not back down.
One bit, yeah. And and in response to, can I help you with something? I said, yeah, you can. You can tell me at what point this person's lateness becomes their own problem instead of everyone else's. No answer. Mm. Just a, sorry, we're holding the screening. Thank you for your patience. And I turned and just walked away. I was like, oh, man, I have been bested.
Yeah.
Furthermore, it is kind of a good lesson to be taught before you sit down to watch the Peanuts movie. Because the world of Peanuts is one of being disappointed. And one where you are reminded
of failure.
Often, not a failure, but of your own insignificance. You don't matter so much that we're not even going to start this movie on time.
Maybe it was an interactive experience that tried to get us into that headspace.
It was 4D. Yeah. So, you know, I got over it and thought, well, this just means I am Charlie Brown.
There you go.
And all of us, except for the late person, is also Charlie Brown. Mm.
So, I feel like I've been talking about this movie all week in various
you have been.
Venues, so...
I will tell you what happens.
Okay.
The little red-haired girl in this version of the Peanuts world is new. She's just moved to town. Charlie Brown is, understandably, smitten with her. That's the movie. That is the entire...
that's the spine of the film.
That is the entire narrative purpose of this film. Will Charlie Brown have the nerve, find the words, the internal stuff, to talk to the little red-haired girl? Around Charlie Brown are all the things that you associate with the world of Peanuts. Schroeder. Fighting off Lucy's advances and playing Beethoven. Snoopy causing mischief.
And dreaming about the Red Baron.
Dreaming about the Red Baron. Typing letters. Mm-hmm. Woodstock fluttering around, bonking into things. Lucy holding the football and not allowing Charlie Brown to kick it.
There's some new stuff.
Hang on. No, there is no
yes,
new stuff.
Yes, there is.
You tell me what those new things
okay,
are.
Okay, the whole thing of Charlie Brown being thought to be a genius.
Ah, no, and that's where you're wrong.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yes.
That was done before?
In A Boy Named Charlie Brown becomes the spelling champion.
Right.
And everyone is sort of celebrating his
acumen.
His ability to spell. And they sent him off to the competition. So every single thing that happens in this film has an antecedent, either in those comic strips or in the TV specials.
If you're going to put that to find a point on it.
I'm going to. Or in the TV specials or in the feature films.
What about Charlie Brown doing magic or doing the school dance? Those I thought those were new.
I don't think the magic thing was new. I think, well, the dance was new.
Yeah.
Okay. You get that.
Fine. But as I argued with Christy...
But that leaves the 98% of the rest of the film.
Okay. The whole point, I think, of Peanuts has pretty much always been the repetition of plots and tropes and jokes.
That is why I'm saying both of you are right.
Yeah.
Christy, her attack on it... She's 100% correct. There is absolutely nothing new in this film. You are also correct in that is the world of the Peanuts.
Yeah.
All right, so.
As somebody pointed out, you know, so what, you want like the Smurfs or the Chipmunks where they bring them all up to date and snazzy and new and bleh?
So here's why I think it's okay that both of you are right. The strip ended 15 years ago. Charles Schulz died around the same time. He died very quickly after the strip ended.
Yeah, yeah. Like the last strip, I think, ran on January 1st, 2000, he died within a month or two of that.
I think. So, that means that Peanuts hasn't been anything resembling a dominant
cultural
force in well over 15 years. And in fact, let's just be real, longer than 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, it hit its peak in the late 60s.
But in the late 60s, early 70s, you could not turn around or leave the house without seeing, hearing something related to Peanuts.
They were on the moon.
Indeed. Just this week on my Instagram, I took a picture of the radio speaker at the laundromat. And I said, here's the speaker for the radio at the laundromat. It's where Coast 103.5 comes out. And it's proof that you don't need to go looking for Adele. She'll find you. No matter where you go. You don't have to watch that video. You don't have to go buy that song. It's coming to you.
It will be in your bloodstream in
no time. It will be in your ears. You don't have a choice. So that's the level that Peanuts were on in the late 60s, early 70s.
Right.
They were everywhere.
It was a Broadway show. They were on TV. They were in newspapers that people read.
They were on cans of dog food.
Right.
They were
pillows and
still
sweatshirts.
Are the life insurance commercials. Yeah. They were on t-shirts and pillows and you name an object.
Zingers.
Name an object. Foods. Yeah, everything. So you could count on, the specials or the TV shows, the specials or the movies, to take what you already knew about Peanuts and sort of build on it.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be the first exposure many children will have to Peanuts.
Sure.
Outside of perhaps the TV specials. Yeah.
And for years to come, I think.
If you are a conscientious parent and you're exposing your child to important cultural stuff of the past or from your own life, you've made sure that those kids have watched Great Pumpkin, Thanksgiving, Christmas.
Yeah.
But that's just a small percentage of the population because there's so much TV out there now. There's no guarantee that every kid has seen a Charlie Brown Christmas.
True.
Back when it was on, back when it was invented, there were three channels.
Right.
When you and I were little kids, there were three channels.
Right.
If one thing on primetime television was a cartoon at night, oh yeah, you were watching it. So this is going to be most children's, young children's first exposure to Peanuts. So
it's also going to be a DVD that they have that they can watch all year. Yeah. That isn't like holiday centric.
This is essentially a rebooting of the Peanuts world. And as such, it serves as kind of a primer to that world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a world where very few people subscribe to newspapers anymore. Right. And there's not a fresh Peanuts comic strip in the newspaper 6 days a week, 7 days a week,
yeah,
or however many days a week.
Seven days a week.
Yeah. So
color on Sundays.
Yeah. So the idea that there's nothing new in this film, unless you are an adult who's basically our age,
mm-hmm,
and going to see it looking for some fresh Peanuts input.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not that person, then you're going to enjoy it just fine. It's sweet. It's comforting. There's a softer version of the sadness, disappointment, failure, melancholy that everyone always talks about.
Mm-hmm.
It does soft sell that stuff to a degree.
But
it's still there. It's still there. It's just not... It ain't A Boy Named Charlie Brown or Snoopy Come Home. It's not the kind of movie you show to toughen your kids up.
But at the same time, I mean, I was thinking about this, though. Charlie Brown Christmas, for as much as it's about, you know, failure and getting things wrong, whatever, it does end on an upbeat.
Happily, as does Snoopy Come Home, which puts you through the ringer.
Yeah.
A Boy Named Charlie Brown ends on kind of a melancholy note,
mm-hmm,
that feature film.
Yeah.
Although not agonizingly so.
Yeah.
it basically ends with Linus saying, okay, well, you screwed everything up. And now you're depressed. But did the world come to an end? No. Get up. Get out of bed. Let's go do some fun thing or whatever.
Yeah.
That's the end of the movie.
Yeah. Carry on.
Yeah. So, if you are not, you know, a diehard Peanuts person,
mm-hmm.
and you are not looking for
innovation
other than in digital animation,
yeah,
it's fine.
And the digital animation is a little jarring at first, but it doesn't. You get used to it.
Yeah, it's sweet and it's gentle and it's. I will say at the end, maybe it's even a little moving, because it's not just that there's a happy ending. It's a heartfelt sort of, you know, we like you, Charlie Brown kind of ending, which is nice.
Yeah,
yeah.
If you are a hardcore Peanuts fan and you would like to hear Dave and me expound for 80 minutes about this.
Sell it.
We have just recorded a Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode devoted to Snoopy Come Home, which you can listen to as a commentary track or as a freestanding, you know, not even long, just a freestanding episode of the podcast. It costs $1.99. You can get it by PayPaling us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And we'll be happy to email you a copy of it.
Speaking of lateness.
Okay.
I went to see the new Frederick Wiseman film in Jackson Heights.
Yes.
And it started, you know, air quotes, on time.
Mm.
Meaning
it was within your 10-minute.
It was scheduled to start at 3.
Right.
And 3-hour and 15-minute film.
Woo.
Well, don't woo. It's Frederick Wiseman.
I know. That's his
average. What do you walk into a Frederick Wiseman movie that's 2 hours and you're like, what is this, a sitcom? Like,
a featurette?
Yeah. His films are known
for
being quite lengthy.
Yeah.
Anyway, it started at 3:10. I got there at 10 till, took my seat. 3 o'clock. Happens. There's no one else in the screening room. The publicist walks in and says, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I go, about what? She goes, well, we're waiting for someone. I go, that's okay. I go, it's not supposed to start for another 10 minutes. She goes, no, no, no. I like to start things on time. I go, where did you come from? I said, that's not how it works. I said, everything starts 10 minutes. You get 10 minutes. It's 10 minutes after. That's the world. That's the world of screenings, 10 minutes after the time.
Yeah.
She goes, well, we're only waiting for one more person. I go, seriously, only one more person signed up to come to this? In runs, huffing and puffing, Manola. Herself going, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I go, will everyone please calm down?
That would be our friend Manola Dargis of the New York Times.
I go, did you really run here? She goes, yes, I saw your name on the sign-in sheet. And I just thought, oh, no, I can't be late. Dave's going to be angry. I was like, no. You actually have 7 more minutes before it's technically supposed to start.
Catch your breath.
She's the most polite human being in the world when it comes to
punctuality,
theater behavior.
Yes.
So yeah, anyway, like from one extreme to the other, from one screening where they're
can
like,
I help you?
Where they're like, yeah, what are you going to do about it? Sure would be a shame if something happened to this screening. If you didn't stop complaining to people literally apologizing to my face for no reason. Manola and I had a very nice time watching this show. Yes.
And then later that day, I saw her at Trumbo, and there were maybe only 2 other people in there. So it was a day of intimate screenings for Ms. Dargis.
So In Jackson Heights is yet another terrific documentary from Frederick Wiseman.
Yeah, he's the modern master.
I have explained Frederick Wiseman to no fewer than 5 people this week. Mm. People who I actually sort of... Well, some of them I actually sort of thought would know who he was.
Yeah. LAFCA presented him with a Life Achievement Award career achievement award a couple years ago.
Did he show up? Was I?
Did.
Where was I? Was that the year I didn't go?
It was a year you didn't go. I think you were out of town because I remember I got sick at the last minute and couldn't go.
Okay.
I was supposed to present to somebody French. I think something like Holy Motors, maybe. And then I got sick and I wound up watching the whole thing online. Robert presented my place.
Oh, I see. Anyway, if you don't know who Frederick Wiseman is, I will tell all of you right now. He's possibly the greatest documentary filmmaker in the world.
Living, certainly.
Yeah. And his films, they feature some very, very specific and consistent
technique
traits. No narration, no interviews of any sort,
no non-diegetic music,
correct, no score, no nothing.
Yeah, I just love getting to say diegetic.
I know, it's a word you like to say.
Oh, my kids that I teach once a week.
Kids, huh?
My kids in their 20s love to say diegetic.
And the titles of his films are always very, you know, just the facts.
Yeah.
And that's kind of encompassing his style.
Hospital, The Store.
Yeah. Now,
Belfast, Maine,
I know that he has sort of rebelled against the idea of being called objective or just plain old observational. Because, you know, when you
there's no such thing.
You choose where your camera is going to point, and you choose how it's going to be edited.
Exactly.
When you're done. So that's not objective at all.
Yeah, no one, if you want objective, get, like, security cam footage.
But what you do get with a Wiseman film is a deep
dive
into a place or an institution or a business or a political body. So this one, along with Belfast, Maine, and Aspen, and I would actually argue even Public Housing.
I was gonna say Public Housing. Yeah, put in this category. Yeah.
It's another one of his going to a community and filming stuff that happens in the community.
Right,
kind of films. Now, I just watched Belfast, Maine for the very first time this week on a crappy VHS tape that you and I have had for the past almost 20 years. No, I take that back. 16, 15 years. It's from 1999.
Well, you know,
and it was on PBS right away, and we taped it.
Yeah.
And then put it in the closet. And it never got watched.
It occurred to me that we're probably not doing what's left of our VHS library any favors by lying them down flat. I think because what gravity does apparently is make the tapes kind of slide down the spindle.
Oh, really?
We're supposed to actually keep VHS tapes up like
this. Oh, are you?
Yes.
I didn't know that. So I watched Belfast, Maine, and it was really great to see both of them in the same week because there's so much that's similar in the films. You know, so many things that he likes to show you. He loves community meetings. People all...
Just like Gilmore Girls.
Yeah, he loves town meetings. He loves, you know, special meetings called by citizens groups for this or that thing. City council meetings. He loves laundromats. Apparently, as well. Entire sequences of people in laundromats in both films. You also get, in both of them, scenes of evangelical Christians doing things. In Belfast, Maine, you get to see a church service, a baptism taking place. I shouldn't call it a baptism. In the evangelical world, you don't baptize a baby when they're babies.
Right.
It's not like you...
Papists.
You Marianists.
It's Mariolaters. Thank you.
What you do with a baby is you dedicate the child. And so this was a baby dedication.
I see.
Where the parents bring the baby down to the front, the preacher's like, you know, you present this child to, and you're gonna promise to raise this child, you know, knowing Jesus.
Right.
In Jackson Heights, you see some street missionaries, which I really wish he had spent more time on, because that's a thing that I know very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not what you're thinking. It's not street preachers yelling at people.
Mm-hmm.
It's groups of young people, almost always young white people.
Mm-hmm. You might explain where Jackson Heights is for people living.
Queens, New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see this youth, basically a youth group, maybe a college Young Life group.
Mm-hmm.
Young Life is a
yes.
an evangelical organization, sort of a para-church organization. You see them on the street, apparently doing, it looks like they're picking up trash. I don't know what their thing is. But the minute someone recognizes sort of who they are and what they're doing, they're praying with this person. Like, they drop those bags of trash. They're like, it's time to pray, you guys. And so, and that's the thing that happens. The evangelicals will send young groups of young people to perceived areas of need.
Mm-hmm.
Usually some big bad city where they think everything is rotten and gross.
Right.
And that's when they will, you know, go in and try to do a little evangelization.
And witness.
And witness, yes. Yes. You know that word.
I do.
Yeah. The other thing he likes to show you is animal processing. In Belfast, Maine, there's a fishery.
Uh-huh.
And I was trying to figure out which fishery it is because my mother worked in one in Maine.
Oh, wow.
When I was a kid. And it's, Belfast is too far up the coast for it to have been that one, but I still want to know.
This is when you lived in New Hampshire?
Yeah, when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. They show you a fishery. They show you, you know, people dicing up fish real fast, putting them in little tins, you know. And in Jackson Heights, you see a shop that like a poultry shop that will sell you a freshly killed chicken. Like, they've got the live chickens in the back, and I didn't even think this was legal anymore, but apparently, or maybe it's not. Who knows? They got those chickens in the back, and you get to watch from start to finish a chicken get its throat cut.
Mm-hmm.
And then put through the machinery and the plucking and the skinning, all that stuff. Completely gross, but fascinating. And it's juxtaposed with a beauty salon where a pedicure is happening on one of the gnarliest set of feet I've ever seen. When it was over, Manola goes, you know, I didn't need to see the chicken thing. I said, you know what? I can watch that 7 times in a row. Don't show me feet, please. In the state that particular set of feet was in.
So at the end of the sequence, you have like a plucked chicken and a shiny, smooth foot?
No, you don't get to see the outcome of the foot.
Oh.
You just get to see the digging into the gross foot.
Ew.
Yeah, and I was like, this is, I'm fascinated by the chicken being, I don't.
Not so much the foot.
Well, you know, I mean, I eat meat. And so, like, I want to know. I don't want it to be hidden from me.
Sure.
I want it to be shown what happens to an animal before it comes to me.
Manola's all vego.
I think she is. Do we know this about her?
She's a vegetarian. She's not a vegan. She's a vegetarian.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think we're outing her.
No. I just don't know if that's a factor.
Yeah.
But yeah, that pedicure was gnarly. Now, if it sounds like there's no narrative here, you're kind of right, but you're also kind of wrong. He takes you through the world of Jackson Heights, Queens. Mm-hmm. And what you see in the film is immigration procedures. You see an LGBT advocacy group. You see a group of concerned business owners who are all about to be run out of a mini mall by greedy landlords because they've used up Manhattan and they've used up Brooklyn and now they're going after Queens.
Great.
They are, you get to see, you know, a school district stuff, a musical performance at a laundromat, eyebrow threading, which I do not understand. You watch it happening, and I still don't know
what it is.
Yeah. I'm just looking at my notes here. a tattoo shop where they sell bongs that are shaped like penises. There's a really moving sequence set in a senior center.
Hmm.
There's a 98-year-old woman. And she's talking to a bunch of other women, also old. And she's like, I'm 98. I'm the last person I know left alive.
Wow.
I have no friends.
Yeah.
Which is heartbreaking. Yeah. One of the other old ladies goes, but you have money. And the lady's like, so what? And she goes, money talks. You can pay. You can hire young people to come talk to you. You can even hire a boyfriend. You have money.
When I think about Wiseman's stuff that I've seen, I haven't seen this one, but I definitely want to. I'm reminded of that line from My Dinner with Andre.
Yeah.
Where Wally Shawn says, you know, people talk about how you have to climb Mount Everest, like that's the way to really perceive reality. And he says, there's a reality going on next door in the cigar store that would blow your mind.
Right.
And I feel like that's what Wiseman's films do, is they tell you the reality in the cigar store, you know, or the neighborhood or whatever. Like he goes in deep and he just, you know, lets these things unfold and he doesn't comment on them. And but
his transitions are really nice. Lots of cool sound, continuity and editing that moves you from one place to another, but completely different place, but it all feels like it's supposed to be together.
You just get immersed into these places that you might never go to in your life and might never understand, you know, in a direct way. But by watching what Wiseman captures in that, it brings it to life, and it, you know, it kind of just puts you in this headspace, and you know, it doesn't have to be about some giant earth-shattering event. It can just be about the people talking at the senior center or the people processing the chickens or whatever.
The thing that it keeps coming back to is the fact that it was shot in the summer of 2014 during the World Cup.
Oh.
But in this context, you know, you see a school teaching kids, teaching local Muslim kids, you know, Islam lessons, you know, a belly dancing exercise class, a trans women's support group, people watching the World Cup in bars, a Hindu temple, a recording studio in session, this a gay bar that they go to with these go-go boys that are dancing on the things, dancing on the bars, a priest talking about drug addiction, and he has no idea what he's talking about.
Well, okay.
You don't see any real corporate stuff except a shot of a Gap and a shot of a Starbucks. And if there's a theme going on in the film, it's that there is a community here. There are 167 languages spoken in Jackson Heights.
Wow.
And they are sort of this microcosm of the United States. Like they have everything there. And the threat to it is developers who do not have a sense of
the community.
And so what I feel like this is actually the point of the film. You don't, it's not quite like Belfast, Maine, where he's showing you a place that doesn't change much because it's fairly isolated. He's showing you a place that really is about to change big unless everyone sees what everyone else is doing and that everyone else is necessary. So it's very compassionate and it's very, you know, pro folks.
Right.
And so,
and if nothing else, it's probably like a snapshot of a community that 10 years from now, 20 years from now is going to be completely unrecognizable because of,
yes,
you know, the developers and whatever else is going on.
So it's fantastic. It just opened in New York.
Right.
It is only in New York right now.
Mm-hmm.
It opens in Los Angeles in a week or two, just before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And then slowly probably rolling out. I bet it'll end up being one of those things where it may play at a museum.
Sure.
Near you somewhere.
If you go to Wiseman's website at Zippora Films, Zipporah, I'm sure they have like a, they'll announce cities.
Probably, yeah.
So keep an eye out for it. I know all week you've been hearing about Frederick Wiseman, Frederick Wiseman, Frederick Wiseman. But, you know, we also want to focus on some of the smaller indie films. So let's talk about Spectre.
It's fine. Spectre's fine.
Yeah, it's okay. It's
I had a good time watching that James Bond movie the same way that I have a good time watching the Spider-Man movie. I don't care. I don't care. I'm not one of the people who is lining up to crap on Skyfall now, which I feel is happening.
Yeah, that's what I had no idea there was this backlash brewing out there.
Yeah, but this one is minor.
Yeah,
for sure. Talk about it.
Well, I'm looking
up Zipporah Films to see what's going on with the release dates. Jackson Heights.
I went on the Just the Worst podcast this week, movie podcast this week, and I said that it's basically the minimum daily allowance of 007. Like, you get enough of the stuff that you want out of one of these movies, you know, the big action-y set pieces and the, you know, the pretty ladies and the, you know, Bond being Bond kind of stuff. It's not special or memorable or a standout. It is solidly mid-level Bond. Like, you've got those four or five that you think of as the really great ones, and then you've got maybe at the bottom of the list another handful that, ugh, you know, you just would never want to see again. And then this one's just sort of in the middle. One thing that I didn't realize that they were going to keep doing so much is that these Daniel Craig Bond movies are all very interconnected. Like, they sort of started the whole story over again with Casino Royale, and unlike the previous Bond movies, where there might be occasionally be like a Felix Leiter who pops up from movie to movie, or like a passing reference to Bond's dead wife or something.
Right.
They really expect these movies to carry one into the other, and so you're expected to remember what went down in Quantum of Solace in this movie, which I do not remember what happened in Quantum of Solace.
They help you.
Yeah, they walk you through it.
You're not going to give away the reveal, are you?
No.
Because I just woke up this morning and read Matt's review.
Matt Seitz?
Seitz. Yeah. He totally gives away the
well,
the reveal.
The reveal is, I think, one of the worst.
I mean, you have to be kind of dumb not to get it.
Yeah.
And that's who I am, though.
Well, yeah, you would have to be Dave White, who didn't know that Prometheus was an Alien prequel. Until, what?
This is what happens when you don't pay pre-attention,
I guess,
to what's happening. Like, when you seriously shut out information.
But here's the thing: it's like what you said about Adele. I don't chase this stuff down. It's just there.
I know.
It's just in my oxygen.
Right.
But yeah, there are references to the previous films, and a culmination of sorts here that's supposed to be more of an aha moment than I think it really is. But basically, we begin with Bond in Mexico City.
I said, actually, aha, when they dropped the first visual clue.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because when they dropped the first visual clue, I was like, oh!
Aha.
Me am dummy. Yeah.
Bond is in Mexico City for the Day of the Dead celebration, and there's a very snappy tracking shot that goes like through the parade and follows him into this hotel and into an elevator and out of the elevator and into a room and out the window and
across
the rooftop. And that's pretty cool. And there's a big explosion, and there's a big fight in a helicopter over a very crowded plaza of people who don't seem to be in a hurry to get out of the way of a helicopter that could come crashing into them at any moment. And that's arguably the best part of the movie. But there are some other exciting fights and stuff, and Dave Bautista is sort of the number two villain, and he's a formidable opponent, and you've got Monica Bellucci and Lea Seydoux as the Bond girls.
Although, let's just be real, Monica Bellucci is in the movie for 5 minutes.
Yeah, she has two scenes.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's Monica Bellucci, so
you can't
help noticing her. And Bond has to go rogue, and someone nefarious is going to be taking over MI6. And
right.
I had a fine enough time.
I feel like this is as solidly made a James Bond movie as any of the others I've seen since Daniel Craig
took over
as Bond. This series of Bond films, starting with Craig, have a much more self-serious quality to them.
Yeah, this is the quote-unquote grim and gritty Bond.
We're not we're not in the age of Roger Moore and, you know.
Or Pierce Brosnan and the Invisible Car.
Yeah, you know, I thought Christmas only came once a year, you know, like that, that right. kind of thing. Like, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
This is
badass Bond.
Yeah, this is sort of miserable Bond. Like, he's always got a look in his face like, ugh, it's such a pain being James Bond, you know.
It's true. He doesn't seem to be enjoying any of this.
Yeah. But that doesn't. But even that's though, not but he, his
but
he's, job.
But he still manages to pull a white tuxedo out of nowhere yeah. when he needs one. You know,
his job is not to be happy. No. I don't care if James Bond is happy or sad. I just want him to do James Bondy things.
Right.
And he does them.
He does them. There are enough James Bondy things. Good.
It doesn't.
When it's over, you will think that sure was a Bond movie.
Yeah. It doesn't push. The envelope in any way in terms of, you know, when we were kids, it used to be like the Bond movies were the ones that where you saw the wildest stunts and the sexiest stuff and the craziest sort of like villains, and
they were head and shoulders above.
Other people do that now,
yeah,
and they do it better. The latest Mission Impossible movie is better than this. What was the one? What was the
Rogue Nation?
Rogue Nation that came out this year?
Yeah.
Better than this.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
Significantly better than this.
Sure.
But
different, you know. I mean,
but different. But the thing is that, it, you know, in this world, we still have to contend with things like Hitman, Agent 47. And in that...
Kingsman, the Secret Service.
Right. In that, if we're gonna have the continuum out there... Mm-hmm. Bond is on the side of good and not bad.
Sure.
It doesn't matter if this is minor Bond, if it's not as big or grand as Skyfall. It's still an entertaining James Bond film. Yeah. I've been reading a lot of really, really, really negative stuff about it. And I've been thinking, y'all don't see enough bad movies.
Or even enough bad Bond movies. Go back and watch License to Kill with Timothy Dalton. That was the worst. But it's funny though, the two big figures at the movies this weekend are, you know, you could have 50 years ago.
It's 1969.
Had you know, like, in, you if this were 1965, you could have like think pieces about James Bond and Charlie Brown.
Yes.
You know, and they're still out there kicking.
Yeah.
And then speaking of the past, I saw Trumbo.
Right.
Which is a drama, but a drama with some humor to it, about screenwriter Dalton Trumbo and the Hollywood 10 and the McCarthy era blacklist. And you know, this is the kind of story that Hollywood loves to tell about itself, you know, because like Hollywood liberals get to be victims and then heroes, you know. And it was indeed a crappy time, you know, in this country where... We had actually sort of built some bridges to the Soviet Union in the 1940s, you know, during World War II. But then suddenly when the Cold War started, anybody who had any kind of communist affiliations either had to loudly and publicly renounce them and, you know, finger all of their fellow travelers or be, you know, faced with, you know, career suicide. And so that's a familiar story, and that's a story that I've seen in a lot of movies and a lot of TV stuff and whatever. But what I liked about Trumbo was that it kept going. It wasn't just about, oh, the McCarthy hearings and, oh, the Hollywood 10 and this was so bad. Because then, what this movie's really about is, well, then what happened?
Yeah.
What happened between Trumbo being stripped of his reputation in Hollywood, where he had been the highest paid screenwriter working, and his return to the public light when basically both Kirk Douglas and Otto Preminger were like, screw it, I'm giving you a credit on Spartacus and Exodus, respectively. You know, how did he survive? What did he do during those years? That's what this movie is about.
Right.
And what he did was basically figure out a way to hammer out a lot of scripts for low-budget movies, both himself and getting work for his friends and figuring out, you know, how to do all of this on the DL and get paid and not get credited and at least still work. And what toll did all that have on his family life and on his friendships and on his professional relationships? Bryan Cranston plays Dalton Trumbo. Right. And I think he's really great. He's doing a voice. And oh, we got to talk about Spotlight this week.
Yeah, we do.
I forgot about that. He's doing a voice. And at first, I was a little distracted by it. And then after a while, I wasn't. It worked. And I understood, you know, it was a character and he was doing an accent. And it felt like a character and not just a guy doing a voice. And and I found it really effective. And his wife is played by Diane Lane. Louis C.K. has a great supporting performance as a, not an actual guy. I think he's probably a composite or something of several right. characters, named Arlen Heard, who is a much, I mean, they're all committed to their ideologies, but he's always kind of busting on Trumbo for the fact that Trumbo was rich and lived like a rich guy and had, right. you know, a nice house with a big lake and stuff. And Trumbo didn't have a problem with that. So they have these arguments that are, I think, some of the best stuff in the film. Helen Mirren plays Hedda Hopper, who was a super right-winger and used her position of power not only to denigrate people whose ideology she disagreed with, but also to lean on studio heads to not hire those folks and to really sort of enforce the blacklist. And she's something to behold. yeah, I found this movie really entertaining and really smart. It's directed by Jay Roach, who I mainly think of as, oh yeah, the guy who did the Austin Powers movies and who's married to Susanna Hoffs. But he did Game Change for HBO.
Yes.
He did the Campaign, which I didn't like, but it was about politics. The one with Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis, remember that one?
Oh yeah, that was funny.
Yeah, it was all right.
It was funny.
It was whatever.
Yeah.
But I like this one a lot. I think it has a lot to say about the nitty-gritty of, you know, I like when you can take these sort of grand political tableau and then boil them down to, okay, well, how does this affect this person, this one guy, this one person who's sort of caught up in this current of history, you know? And it's not about politicians and it's not about heads of state. It's just about the people who have to deal with the residual fallout from it all. And yeah, and obviously there's a lot of fun kind of inside baseball movie nerdy stuff that I enjoyed, you know, where, you know, his Trumbo's family gather to watch the Oscars where Roman Holiday wins an Oscar, but it's got his friend's name on it because he was already blacklisted by that point. And they gather again to watch, you know, the Oscars, and he wins an Oscar for The Brave One, which had the name of his dog on it because, you know, he was completely anonymous. And he couldn't, like, I don't think he admitted for like another decade that he'd actually written that film. And the guy playing Kirk Douglas is a pretty good Kirk Douglas. And it doesn't feel like this sort of weird Hollywood waxwork. The guy playing Otto Preminger is really good at being Otto Preminger. yeah, I had a blast. I really enjoyed this movie.
I'll probably wait for the screener to show up.
I'm sure we'll get one.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah,
we will. So, Spotlight.
Spotlight opens. Yeah, I talked about it a little on the Venice episode with Peter DeBruges because I saw it there. But you saw it this week, so why don't you...
It is about the Boston Globe and their Spotlight team of investigative reporters. And that's the name of the team. They call themselves Spotlight. And they take on any subject they feel like taking on, and they spend a long time investigating it.
Yeah,
they do the kind of old school investigative reporting
that takes years,
that takes months or years to accomplish. And so they work slowly and they work methodically. And so this film is essentially a procedural where they go after over 80 Catholic priests in Boston alone who have been accused and formally sort of dealt with by the church for raping children.
Yeah.
And so, and they encounter a lot of problems along the way.
Boston's a very Catholic town. And it's a smaller town than you would think when you start uncovering this kind of
stuff. And it happened in the year 2000, 2001.
Yeah.
And so it's got Rachel
McAdams,
Rachel McAdams, Mark Ruffalo,
Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton.
Brian Darcy James.
I'm blanking on all the names.
Brian Darcy James. They're the main investigators. Yeah. And then their editor is played by John Slattery from Mad Men. And then the new editor who's come in, who's an outsider because he's not a Bostonian, he's not even a Catholic, is Liev Schreiber.
Liev Schreiber.
What's also cool about this movie, in addition to being a great procedural and really sort of taking you step by step on how you break a story like this, it's also set very specifically at the dawn of the internet. You know, there's a big America Online billboard looming over the staff parking lot at the Globe.
Yeah.
And the more that the internet, it kind of takes over journalism, the harder it is to find people who have the patience and the pockets to fund this sort of long-term, deep well journalism. You know, everything now is so like fast and instant and quick and soundbite and whatever.
And it's about getting the click immediately and first.
Yeah. And so the notion of having staff that they said that it'll take them months even just to decide if it's going to be a story they pursue or not.
Yeah.
Much less than the years involved in getting the story and getting the story right, feels like, you know, the 1930s or something. It's so divorced from what the media has become right now, and a reminder of why this kind of thing is important.
And they still exist.
Yeah.
The Boston Globe has kept them.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you know, that's harder and harder to come
by. Sure
I'm
sure at hefty cost.
Sure.
But
Rachel Maddow always says, support your local paper, you know.
Yeah.
Because so often they're reporting on things that wind up having national significance, but that start out as local stories, and nobody else is going to cover them when they're local stories.
Right. And this is not a film that gives you, in filmmaking terms, the kind of punch that you might be expecting. It is, much like the reporting style itself, it's very methodical.
Level-headed.
It is. There is no...
soaring triumph music.
Yeah. I saw it with friend Gary Cuddy, who, when we walked out, he said, you know what I liked? He goes, there weren't too many shots of children playing on swings in front of a Catholic church. It was like that happened once, but it happens because the character is standing there going, look at this, look at this. Like, this is a thing it's right in front of us. See it? You know, and it's not like the movie is giving it to you saying, think about it, won't you? You know, it's not like that.
Dun, 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 dun.
It's and you know the outcome, you know the ending. You know, they go after these guys. But even the ending isn't, you know, dun, 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 yeah. Journalists, save the day. It's absolutely pulled back from that. Yeah. It is level-headed and it is calm. Which means, as really, really good as it is, it's a really well-made film and has almost a non-style, if you will. I wonder if audiences will respond to it, if that audience is looking for something more cathartic.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, it's funny because from the moment I posted my review out of Venice, I was immediately getting comments online of, well, this is an old story. The Catholic Church doesn't do this anymore. It's all fixed.
No, it's not.
Okay, A,
no,
it's not.
No, it's not.
And B, even if so, we're talking generations of children who suffered here. That's like saying, oh, World War II ended. Why tell Holocaust stories?
And let's be real for a minute here. Why do you think we have a cool new pope?
Oh, yeah. No question.
Why do you think they allowed this? I'm putting cool in air quotes. Why do you think we have this cool new pope?
Why do we have a living pope step down for the first time in centuries?
Yeah.
Because they want to change the conversation.
Yeah.
They want to put this in the past and pretend like it's a thing that's over. It's not over. And it's not only is it not over for the all the people who are still alive, who are still dealing with the consequences and wondering how the church could allow these people to move from parish to parish without, you know, being taken out of the field or put behind bars.
Yeah.
But it's still happening, you know, in other parts of the world, and probably even in the United States.
One of the things you learn in the film is that story, when it finally broke, led to the uncovering of the same situation in dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of other places.
Yeah. And Cardinal Law, who was the main person who looked the other way while it all happened in Massachusetts, what happened to him after the story ran? He got a cushy job at the Vatican.
Right. So this film is absolutely relevant, even though it's set in 2001. It's incredibly well made. The performances are great because they are so understated. Mm-hmm. And not showy. They're not Oscar performances, because Oscar voters want a louder style of acting.
There's a Mark Ruffalo, who's the one performance in this movie that I had a problem with, because I felt so.
He's the one who gets to yell.
He gets to yell. I think in my review I even said he gets a "for your consideration" moment at the end of the film where he gets all mad and is like, "Whoa, we got to run it now!"
Right.
You know. So that's the one time that it sort of leans into that brand of histrionics. But yeah, for the most part, it's a lot more subdued and a lot more human. Our internet friend Michael Cyril Creighton plays one of the victims.
Yeah.
And he's a guy who I've only ever seen do comedy. And in this short, dramatic role, I found very moving.
Yeah.
It's a terrific movie. The idea that that Tom McCarthy could make this and The Cobbler in the same year,
that blows my mind.
Is stunning.
That's a turnaround.
Yeah, that's a Sandra Bullock winning an Oscar and a Razzie in the same year kind of dichotomy. Go see Spotlight. I think it's just opening limited this weekend and going wider, but when it gets to you, go see it. It will reward your patience with its lack of flash.
All right, so as we know, I have no feelings.
It's true, you are dead inside.
Except I'm a liar. Brooklyn, that's the name of the movie, I think is engineered in a lab of crying. It is a film from director who, what?
Oh, name the name. I don't have it in front of me. The guy who made Boy A. John.
You look it up while I talk about
it. I can't look it up. My computer's recording this.
You start talking
thing.
About the movie and I'll look it up.
Okay, it's based on a novel by Colm Tóibín. I've been saying his name wrong. I've been saying all the Irish names wrong, apparently. Tóibín. Who is great. And it's the story about a young woman named Eilish, played by Saoirse Ronan.
John Crowley.
John
is the
Crowley,
director.
Thank you. Yeah. It sounds like a character from Downton Abbey. Eilish is living in Ireland in the early 1950s, and there are no opportunities. There are no jobs. There are no good potential husbands. There's just nothing.
There's nothing for her.
So her older sister, who has a job as a bookkeeper and who had been a sort of, I think, a professional golfer or semi-pro or something, sets Eilish up with a priest in New York who can sponsor her trip to across the sea and to emigrate. So she moves to New York, and the voyage is difficult, but luckily she's rooming with a fellow Irish woman who has lived there before and kind of walks her through the ins and outs of, you know, how not to get seasick and how to commandeer the shared bathroom. She arrives in Brooklyn, where all the other Irish immigrants live, and she's lonely and sad and misses home. She gets a job in a department store where she's working under Megan Draper, Jessica Paré.
Jessica Paré, yeah.
Feels very glum. But then, you know, she starts getting used to her new life, and she's taking night courses in bookkeeping at Brooklyn College, and she meets Tony.
Yes.
Played by Emery Cohen, who was terrible on Smash, but was really good in a little indie movie called Four. This sweet Italian boy who just is immediately smitten with her. And
like
begins
in
one
the
of the
most palpable puppy following you around sort of ways that I have seen in a film.
Yeah.
In maybe years.
Their courtship is so It's not that it's not sexual, but it's just so sweet and kind and adoring.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah. It's,
like, the minute he mates her, you know that he, like, suddenly can't live without her.
Right.
Like, when they're old and she dies, he'll just drop dead next to her. And that
after 50 years have passed, he's still going to look at her in that same way that he does. So it's adorable, their courtship.
And then something bad happens.
And she has to go back to Ireland.
And
it's a different place. Suddenly there are business working opportunities for her. And there is a guy played by Donald Gleason from Ex Machina. And so suddenly she has this really tricky choice to make. And what's cool about the movie is that there are no villains here.
No.
And...
Well, there's one, but...
Well, yeah, there is. But
there's one mean lady.
Yeah. But basically, either choice kind of makes sense, and it's not like you know, the obviously great path or the ridiculous "what are you thinking" one. You know, there's a genuine tug in both directions for her, and it's just lovely. You know, my parents emigrated from Spain in the 1950s, so this movie was super pushing my buttons of that kind of thing because I was thinking about them and how they were also acclimating themselves to the United States at that exact same period of time and what that must have been like for them and what did they wear. You know, this movie really gets the look of the outfits and, you know, just the shades of blue and green and orange that you never saw before the 1950s and you haven't really seen since the 1950s. Yeah.
The production design is really beautiful. The period detail is absolutely on point.
Mm.
And... more importantly, the film is directed so gently and carefully and lovingly. Every choice visually is designed to push you deeper into, you know, the heart of this story. And it begins as a story about homesickness. This, like, heavy homesickness.
Mm.
But it's a homesickness for a home that you actually never had. For the home you wish you hadn't had to leave. You know?
This is a movie that totally gets away with the scene where... on Christmas Day, she goes to the soup kitchen and helps serve dinner to all the old Irish guys... and they start singing. And then they sing one of those really sad songs about the homeland. And, oh, man.
This film will have you shedding tears in the first 15 minutes.
Yeah. Okay?
Like, every time Saoirse Ronan cries, you're going to start crying.
She's so empathetic.
If you do not have, like, an overwhelming response to this film, which... is really going for your throat, by the way. I'm not going to, you know, pretend it's subtle at all.
This is Spielberg-level manipulation, but Spielberg-level good manipulation.
But yeah, if you don't have a reaction to this film, you might actually be a person with no feelings. Because I got all teary-eyed many times watching this film. It is so... emotionally present. And when it stops being a film about homesickness, it starts being a film about the quality of devotion to friends, to family, to the person you're in love with. And then it changes again to being a film about something else. And I won't give it away, but
sure.
But it tells you. Right, in the last few moments, it tells you what it's about.
Yeah,
Go see this because I just walked in after having seen it, and I just looked at you, and I was like, "Oh, I love this movie so much!" Like I would take my mom to see
this. Yeah,
if she were still with us,
It's a perfect take your mom movie, but not in a bad way.
Not in a condescending, pandering sort of way. It's just lovely.
And what I also love about it, and the movie never, this isn't on the movie's mind in an overt way, but I think in an era where people are demonizing immigrants for political gain, it's a reminder of how essential the immigrant experience has been in the history of this country and what they've brought to the fabric of this country by being here and by following the opportunities that the U.S. promises and how they in turn make the place even better. That's, you know, I found myself thinking about that during and after. And yeah, I mean, again, my parents were immigrants, and I feel like I know a little more about their story and what it must feel like to leave behind your home and your family and everything you've known and starting over again in a new place, you know?
Right.
What's your DVD pick?
Go to ZipporaFilms.com. ZipporaH. Buy a DVD. Doesn't matter which one. Seriously, pick one that looks interesting to you.
I'd say if you want a good starter Wiseman that is not going to be a 3-4-5 hour commitment, but nonetheless is very much in his style and lets you know what you're in for, watch The Store.
It's in your Christmas movie
book. It's in my Christmas movie
book. And it's pretty delightful.
Yeah.
Like, I think about it from time to time, and I just think, I would watch that again. That is, it's lighthearted.
It's one of his institutional films, but if you don't want to see a movie about a hospital or an insane asylum or a prison, this one's about a store.
Yeah.
And it's about the Neiman Marcus flagship store in Dallas during the 1982 Thanksgiving and Christmas.
And it's only about 2 hours long.
If that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is delightful.
As opposed to something like Near Death, which is...
set in a hospice.
It's set in a hospital, but in the wing where...
The hospice patients.
People are about to die.
Yeah.
It's 6 hours long.
Yeah. So maybe The Store first.
It's heavy. Last year's National Gallery is incredible.
Sure. Crazy Horse.
Crazy Horse is fun.
Has many boobs.
Crazy Horse has all the boobs. Belfast, Maine. You know, if you want to plunk down the money for Belfast, Maine, I think it's one of the more expensive ones because it's a 4-hour film. Belfast, Maine is really pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. It's this very sort of compassionate look at small town life and, I think it's one of his best. But yeah, go to Zipporah Films, buy something, pick one, and just you will not regret it. That's my DVD recommendation of the week. Go there.
My DVD rec this week is The Blackwater Lightship, which is a Hallmark Hall of Fame movie from 2004, also based on a novel by Colm Tóibín. Tóibín? I'm sorry if I'm getting all this wrong. Who also wrote Brooklyn. It is incredibly moving and delightful. It's about three generations of women played by Angela Lansbury and Diane Wiest and Gina McKee. Dealing with a relative who is dying of AIDS or AIDS-related complications. And it's just one of, I think, just a really, really great TV movie and a terrific adaptation of a very powerful novel. It is available on DVD, or if you have Apple TV, there's an app, there's a channel, whatever, called Feelin', F-E-E-L-N, that has a lot of movies from the Hallmark Channel and the old Hallmark Hall of Fames, and that is one of them. So you can watch it there, or you can get it on DVD.
Some letters.
Yes.
So you and I were just on the Stephanie Miller Happy Hour podcast
this
week.
Yes, thank you, Chris Lavoie, for inviting us on.
Yeah, her producer, Chris Lavoie, who's exiting. He's going to leave and
do
a different job now.
But he was on the show last year.
Yeah, he was our guest. He forwarded us an email someone sent to him.
Mm.
A friend, I guess, of his, or I don't know, someone he may know. And she says, I'm very fussy about what podcasts I will listen to. But I listened to a download of the Linoleum Knife podcast, and I instantly loved it.
Oh, yeah.
Good luck, and thanks for all the great moments on the show. And she's talking to him about
the
Stephanie Miller show.
Oh, great. Who wrote that?
A woman named Kathleen.
All right. Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah. This is from someone named Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. First off, I love your podcast. I get excited with every single new one. I remember looking through some of the really old ones when I first started listening, and I heard Dave say that there is no such thing as an age-appropriate film. And I thought to myself, here is a genius. You know what, Barbara?
Don't encourage him.
You're right, Barbara. Once we are of age, what does waking up and living one more day or thousands of days more have to do with an appropriate relationship? We could never say weight, race, or intellect appropriate, so I love him for that, and the fact that on the old episodes, after about 10 minutes, Dave is impatient to end it. That's true. I used to be a real stickler for, let's be done at 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Let's be done at 40 minutes. Let's be done at 50 minutes. Okay, an hour. No more than an hour.
I broke you.
You did. You did. I don't care anymore how long we go. I just don't care. Glad you both decided to continue and to make the podcasts longer. P.S. I also agree with Dave.
Boy.
That's right.
Are you sure you didn't write this letter?
That's right. That's Barbara Streisand, actually.
Oh, okay.
Simply
Barbara.
Yeah. She's my fan.
Clearly. Yeah. I'm chopped liver over here.
I also agree with Dave on the generational thoughts that he loves to dismiss. I find people of all ages think like I do, and finding someone born the same year just means I probably will disagree with them. Keep up the great work. Love your reviews.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks for nothing, Barbara, but thank you, nonetheless.
You're going to read this one.
Okay.
And the reason you're going to read this one is because I'm too embarrassed to read it out loud. I thought about not reading the section...
It's another fan of yours?
That is so effusively about me. But, like, there's just a point where my mock self-aggrandizement has to stop. Like I will mockingly...
Puff your chest out.
I'll goof and puff my chest out all the time, really. But if I have to read an entire paragraph praising me, I start to think that I may actually be pure evil.
All right, pass it over.
So... You're going to be the one to read this letter.
To read a letter. Exciting.
Yeah, it's the whole one, yeah.
Okay. Dear Alonzo and Dave, it's been a while since I've written in, although obviously I've listened to every minute of content you guys have put out. I hope I'm not writing in too late with my favorite memory listening to your guys' show this past year and a half. Just in general, it's been extremely informative and a lot of fun. That's what I love best about your guys' show. You're very real, sincere people rather than, quote, calculated hollow critics, unquote. Then again, that stereotype of the cynical, destructive critic isn't very real in my experience. It's usually literary managers and young industry gatekeepers who don't know much about film since they've spent all their time doing coverage of bad scripts and watching only the most mainstream of films. With you guys, I feel at home. With critics in general, I'm amongst people I can generally learn from. You two have taught me more than I could ever learn in film school. There's such a huge divide in the film...
Oh, that's not true.
I don't know. Depends on the film school. There's such a huge divide in the film world between the window shoppers, suits/industry people, yes, I'm a cliche angry artist, and the people who make the products in said store. That's why I tend to side with the critics, because they know what the F they're talking about. I mean, sure, some critics like Devin Faraci are a bit hyperbolic, making me fantasize about using Amy Nicholson's hand equipped with brass knuckles to smack the beard off that dude's face from
the time. I like Devin Faraci.
But I still respect his knowledge and passion and will continue to learn from him moving forward.
Good.
Let alone with you dudes, who I'd equip brass knuckles and unleash all hell on naysayers for. Now, my most memorable moment. Dave White's beastly, majestic, violently beautiful voice.
Yeah.
Yes, if there was a single phrase I'd coin to describe it, it'd be slaughterhouse chic.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
It's both terrifying and soothing. I only came to know of Dave through being a fan of Alonzo and having discovered him on What the Flick. I spent weeks watching every episode I could, developed a huge crush on Christy, and became kind of obsessed with Ben. That is one sexy mother effer when he gets the waves in his hair going with the silver chain around his neck,
right,
etc.
That's Ben Mankiewicz. Yeah.
After becoming familiar with all of TYT's crew, Cenk, Anna, etc., I kept hearing Dave White being brought up. who the hell was Dave White? Alonzo's husband, sure, but what kind of guy would he be like? Alonzo's a refined gentleman, so I wasn't exactly sure if this Dave White would stack up.
This so-called Dave White.
Exactly. Would I get bored of him? What the hell was he like?
Yes, you will. You'll get bored.
Effing awesome. I clicked play, sat back, and let the intro music finish, and then it happened. That effing voice made my house shake through my subwoofer. His voice was like an audible kaiju tearing through my speakers. My dog started barking. The alarms in my building went off. Blood poured out my nostrils, and I fainted. I woke up several hours later, saw my computer had exploded, and purchased a new laptop. This time, though, I was ready. I managed to listen to the entire podcast without passing out from sheer joy at how badass Alonzo's husband ended up being. I was not disappointed in the least bit. On the same note, hearing Dave cuss alongside Christy and Whitney on the B-Movies podcast was
I'm pretty good at that.
Was better than getting laid. It was a magical, cathartic experience full of wonder and joy. It was like unboxing Christmas presents filled with bars of gold you could melt over Devin Faraci's head like in Game of Thrones.
Let's be nice to Devin Faraci. Let's be nice to Devin Faraci.
Even he asks, too far? Question mark. Like an Italian chef, I kissed the tips of my fingers and threw them in the air like I had been served a beautiful filet mignon.
But I'm not even saying this as someone who is a friend of Devin Faraci's. I've only met him once because of Amy.
Let's all be nice.
We don't know. I don't know the man. I just like what he does.
But with F's instead of frites on the side.
Yeah.
There are plenty of other memorable moments, like when I wrote in about my script Fire in Her Blood, then was actually able to get it optioned within a few months. That situation has devolved into kind of a cutthroat, strange learning experience, but the script has ended up better than ever, so whether I can get the rights back before it goes into production or not, I learned a valuable lesson about being desperate. That script is my
baby.
Those
are good lessons to learn.
Yeah. You should read Reed Martin's The Real Truth.
You're desperate? Get used to it.
That script is my baby and is being held captive at the moment. Whether it soars or crashes, it's out of my hands until March, until the rights revert back to me. Until then, I will be looking forward each and every Sunday to a new podcast with you guys. Thank you for all the wonderful hours of entertainment and the future hard work you will put in for your fans moving forward. You guys truly are fantastic. Sincerely, Sean.
Thank you, Sean.
That's just so lovely. Thank you.
It really... I'm touched. I have feelings.
You so flattered Dave White that he couldn't even read the letter himself.
I just don't, you know, it's like, it's one thing for me to be all like, I'm so great, you know, but it's like when someone else is telling you how great you are, you just want to go hide.
Right.
Yeah.
I hear you. Is that it? Are we done?
Yeah, we're done.
Well, we should talk about exciting new...
oh, yeah, we got things.
Retail opportunities.
Things, yeah, there's things to buy. It's this book. I'll talk about it.
Okay.
It's called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. This here book was written by Alonzo Duralde.
It was.
Published by Limelight Editions mm-hmm. in the year of our Lord, 2010. And the year that we made contact with
the show came on.
The Christmas
that too.
Book. Yeah. Yes. So, it's this book. It's got a lot of Christmas movies in it. And I mean... a lot of Christmas movies. Mm-hmm. You can buy this book on Amazon for pretty cheap because it's been out for 5 years now. And so people who have copies are just, you know, they're trying to get rid of them. However.
Oh, thanks.
Let's not kid ourselves.
Just because you're in the process of...
You haven't broken even for your publisher.
I know, but so, you're in the process of culling our bookshelves, so you're just imagining everyone everywhere throwing books out.
No, I'm talking about retailers who have new
copies. Oh, retailers. Well, yeah, that's
retailers, bookstores that have new copies of your book
yes.
are on Amazon selling them through the other vendors
right.
portion. And they're, you know, they're selling new copies for fairly cheap.
Yes.
But you know what you don't get with that copy that you buy on the cheap?
An autograph.
You don't get the signing of the author. You don't get a special message written to you or to a loved one that you're giving it to. You also don't get what we have come to describe. We've come to describe as the special edition.
Yes.
When you buy this book from us directly, you get treats.
Yes.
You get crickets. You get Christmas treats in the book. Obviously, they're flat
yes.
so that they can fit in a book. Treats and surprises. And we gift wrap it in Christmas paper.
Full service.
Lots of things. You get a lot of nice little things tucked inside this book. Surprises and special items. And that is why it costs $20
Which includes postage.
Which includes postage.
Within the United States.
Within the United States. If you're in Canada, it's going to cost more because, holy cow.
Yeah.
It costs a lot to send a book to Canada or to Europe. If you're in the Europe or the Australia or wherever.
The New Zealands.
We're very sorry. It's going to cost you more.
Yes. And drop an email us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We'll let you know how much more.
Yeah.
But if you're in the U.S., yes, $20.
And you want your copy, $20.
PayPal us.
Is that the cover price, actually? Is that the actual cover price?
The cover price, I think, is $16, and then with postage, it's $20.
Oh, is that how we figured it?
Yeah.
You're right. It's $16.99.
Yeah.
So that's full retail.
Yeah.
Plus and $3 plus postage.
Yeah.
And that's $20.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very fair.
Yeah.
So, yeah, PayPal us, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. It's $20. Make sure that you include that you want this book, because we're selling multiple items now.
Yeah.
That you let me know to whom you want it signed, whether that's you or a loved one, and where you want it sent. Again, whether that's to you or a loved one. We will mail the thing directly to your gift recipient.
Yeah.
Signed
to them. And it'll be a
mystery
to them.
Exactly. So we're totally happy to do that. Or we'll send it to you so that you can have the joy of handing it off in person.
Right.
Also available is the long-awaited audiobook version of Dave White's 2006 memoir, Exile in Guyville.
Totally done DIY.
Yes.
Recorded by us.
In this house.
In this house. sold directly by me. It's pay what you want.
Yes.
So you go to...
exileinguyvillebook.tumblr.com.
Correct.
And you decide how much you think this is what you want to pay for it.
You got $1? That's how much it costs. You got more than $1? That's how much it costs. So, yeah.
It's on you.
Buy that. Then what else? Snoopy Come Home.
Snoopy Come Home, yes.
Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knife.
Correct.
Special episode devoted entirely to the 1972 Peanuts feature, Snoopy Come Home.
Mm-hmm.
We talk all about it and about its context and about how we as critics feel about it, how we as children felt about it.
The impact of Peanuts in the broader culture.
Yeah. And that's $1.99 to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Right. And just make sure you include what movie you want and where you want that emailed, because we have now recorded 10.
Yeah.
10
yeah.
of these Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes, and they are all available on sale right now.
Yeah.
We can offer you Snoopy Come Home, The Poseidon Adventure, What's Up Doc, Clue, Two for the Road, Josie and the Pussycats, The Apple.
What's that other one?
Did I say Clue? I said
did you say Josie and the Pussycats?
I said Josie and the Pussycats.
I don't know. Did you say Two for the Road?
Poseidon Adventure. Oh, man.
Well, Snoopy Come Home is number 8.
Oh, Snoopy Come Home. Thank you. That's the one I forgot.
And then the two Christmas ones.
And then the
ones.
Two Christmas ones, White Christmas and the Mexican Santa Claus. And we're going to go ahead and announce our annual Christmas commentary track is coming up. And this year we're doing a beloved holiday staple in many households. So many people in the process of writing and promoting this book have told me that they watch it every year at Christmas time, and they all seem to think they were the only person who watched it every year at Christmas time. I hate to break it to you.
Technically a Christmas movie.
Everybody watches it this year, every year at Christmas time. That would be 1988's Die Hard, starring Bruce Willis, directed by John McTiernan. That's our commentary this year. So that'll be coming up around Thanksgiving-ish.
Yeah.
So be on the lookout for that. But in the meantime, you've got 10 other commentary tracks you can be purchasing. Each one is $1.99. And you can email us, or PayPal us rather, at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Just include what movie you want to see or hear, rather, and where you what email address you want that sent
so
to.
So many opportunities for you to spend money.
Yes. And very soon, we hope. Very soon, we know.
Not just very. Not just we hope. It's a real thing.
Yes.
It's happening.
Linoleum Knife subscriptions are coming up, and you'll be able to subscribe to the program at various different levels with various different...
From cheap to less cheap.
Yes. Yeah. And all different kinds of goodies at different levels, and everybody will be getting our LKTV podcast, our weekly television podcast, which will be available only to subscribers once the subscribing thing starts. So get
come January.
Yeah, so get a free taste from...
we're doing it. It's all going out for free right now. You get to hear what we're doing, and we're sort of building it as we go.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that all that's happening. I want to thank again Chris Lavoie for having us on the Stephanie Miller Happy Hour this week, and also I want to thank for having me on the Just the Worst Movie podcast this week. That was a lot of fun, and you can find that go to their Facebook page, Just the Worst Podcast. Or I believe they're at JTW Podcast on Twitter. So, as always, we want to thank Blue for our wonderful theme music. You can find more about his work at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to Gray and Matt on the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, and Bibbs and Whitney on the B-Movies podcast, and the Schmoes Know, and Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, and the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, and the Sewers of Paris, and the Joelle Ryan thing, and Fat Guys of the Movies on the Criterion cast, and Film Spotting SVU, and the Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this program for free at iTunes. Do leave us a review. It is a way for other people to find the show, and I forgot again to get the names of the people who reviewed us, but we've gotten some good ones lately, and we could always use more, so please keep those coming.
Yeah.
You can stream the show for free at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com, and there's a little way to click and give us positive feedback there as well. Like our Facebook page, like our Linoleum Knife group page on Facebook, and talk to other fans of the show about the show and movies and anything else you want to bring up. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you with any questions or comments you have about the show, and that's the PayPal address to use to buy any of our awesome stuff.
The end.
The end.
Okay. Goodbye.